I'm going to call the committee to order our House and Agri-Natural Resource Committee, and we're going to hear House Bill 3478 today again. We've had several public hearings on this issue, and we have many questions, and we've invited public testimony only. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3478, and I'm going to have Patrick explain just kind of where we're at, and I'm going to call up several panels, and the committee has many questions to ask these panels. So I think that's where we're going to start. Patrick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House Bill 3478, this is our third hearing on the bill. We had hearings on the 16th and 18th. The bill adds gray wolves to the definition of game mammals. It allows the State Fish and Wildlife Commission to establish a special status classification for the bill, allows for the taking of a wolf without a permit under certain conditions, directs the department to establish a compensation program, and creates a wolf management compensation fund. We have several sets of amendments in your packets. I've included a summary. It's a one-page front and back summary of the five sets of amendments that are included in your packets. There are dash ones and dash twos. Those were from the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Dash four amendments, which I believe were submitted by the Safari Club International, SCI. Dash five amendments are a product of an ad hoc work group that was formed on the issue, and our first panel is going to discuss those, and also the dash six amendments, which were submitted at the behest of the Defenders of Wildlife. That person will be on the first panel, and we'll be able to discuss those as well. This measure has a subsequent report of the House Committee on Budget, and I should let the committee know we have not at this time received a fiscal analysis for the bill, given the referral and given the number of amendments that are before the committee.
Is there also a reason why we haven't received the fiscal that they have told you?
Yes, they are still waiting to for the original bill. The legislative fiscal office is still compiling information from the agencies on that. They have not completed their work on the original fiscal office.
Okay, I'm sure we had some questions on that. Thank you for the summary of the amendments. After the last couple days, after our last Senate bill, and we've been chastised in the press for holding devious amendments, is what it's been told. So believe me, that is not the way this process works. This is a great committee. I'm very proud of the work this committee has done. And so we're going to be looking at all of the amendments, as we always do. So I just wanted to get that on the record and make clear. And thank you, Patrick. I'm going to call up the first panel, Al Elkins, Amarok Weiss, and I hope I say that correctly, Katie Fast, and Roy Elliker. Good morning to all of you, and I don't know who wants to start, but for the record, you know the routine. You have to say your name, and maybe you can explain to us what your group has put together and the amendments that we have before us.
Morning, Chair Smith, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Roy Elliker. I'm Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, in charge of fish and wildlife programs. And in my written testimony today, I've summed up in as succinct way as I could the major changes to the Dash 5 amendments that make to the original bill. I'll go through those quickly. I know you have a number of folks here, Madam Chair, you'd like to hear from, and let me just roll through that written testimony, and then you can turn to someone else. The department appreciates the opportunity to offer comments and a brief summary today of the Dash 5 amendments. Dash 5 amendments evolved to have a week-long discussion process convened by Defenders of Wildlife and including the Farm Bureau, Hunter Association, Wool Growers, Hell's Canyon Preservation Council, and the Department. Several of these same organizations played a major role in the development of the Department's Wolf Conservation Management Plan adopted earlier this year. There was a lot of discussion over the week period. On 3478, but I've tried to summarize the major changes that the Dash 5 amendments make to the bill, and they're listed below in the bottom half of my written testimony. First, that gray wolf will be defined solely as a game mammal, and the Fish and Wildlife Commission will establish special regulations for their management And by this language, once off the state and federal endangered species list, wolf will join many of Oregon's other large mammal species, as some have listed here, deer and elk, mountain goat, antelope, and others, in this designation of management. Second, the criteria regarding livestock protection, landowner protection of livestock will be generally controlled by the federal ESA. This is a big change, and one, of course, in the original bill, there was a state permit required for landowners to protect their livestock on public land. Over the course of negotiations, it was quite a discussion, and in the end, we did away with the permit requirement for public land grazing. And instead of that, all decided in the group that the federal government will set the bar for livestock owners protecting their livestock from wolves. And there is some state criteria for that, that the person be a lawful occupant or have landowner permission, that he has not taken steps to attract wolves or conducted any other activities that bait wolves to an area. And then once a gray wolf has been taken, reasonable efforts will be made to protect the site from disturbance, and so the cause of death and circumstances can be determined. And of course, and this we put this in the statute, but this is a clause in the federal ESA and also under state law. A landowner or anyone else may take an endangered species, in this case it would be a gray wolf, to avoid imminent or grave injury to a person. Lastly, a third major change in the Dash 5 amendments retains the creation of a compensation fund for livestock producers who suffer wolf-related livestock losses and for implementing non-lethal wolf control techniques. This compensation concept, while foreign to Oregon, is a feature of every state that currently has gray wolves, and either through Defenders of Wildlife Bailey Fund or through a state organized and controlled funding process. Major changes to the compensation concept in the Dash 5 include that's going to be available for livestock producers grazing on private land and legally grazing on public land, consistent with Oregon Department of Ag Statutes 607 and 608, and now specifically asked to be read into the record by the Department of Agriculture. And that's pretty much the legally grazing on public land was the definition the Department of Agriculture did supply to us originally, so I don't see any inconsistency there. They just wanted to be sure that it was cited back to their chapters. Compensation fund is retitled the Wolf Management Compensation and Proactive Trust Fund to more accurately describe the types of activities the fund can be used for, including non-lethal control management techniques. And last, subsequent livestock loss reimbursement will not be influenced by the ability of the livestock owner to implement non-lethal control techniques. This was another big issue that was finally resolved after some discussion. In the original bill, as you may remember, when a livestock owner first lost livestock to a wolf attack, if he did not work with folks or implement some kind of non-control or other helpful techniques to reduce potential further attacks, there was a possibility that he might suffer some financial loss for subsequent losses, and that was going to be left up either to the commission or a five-member advisory board. But at this point, the livestock producers will be encouraged to design and implement non-lethal techniques in partnership with ODFW. There would be no linkage of the compensation payments to whether or not they can or would go and implement non-control techniques to discourage wolf predation. Madam Chair, that sums up our prepared testimony to Dash 5 amendments, and be happy to go to questions or hear from other panel members. Thank you.
Do any of the other panel members want to testify?
No, I don't need to. Thank you.
Because I wanted to go to the whole panel before we went to questions.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, for the record, Katie Fast, Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. I'd just like to add that Farm Bureau is in full support of the bill with the addition of the Dash 5 amendments. These amendments add that the take, as Roy said, is consistent with the federal ESA until the time that the wolf is downlisted by the federal government. We will have to live under the federal rules, and we understand that, and so we support the state having their rules consistent with the federal government until the time of downlisting. We've also made some adjustments to the compensation program, and I'd just like to add, for the ranching community and for our membership, the compensation program is important for us due to the fact that ranchers and livestock owners are unable to use the other tools that we have with other wildlife to protect their livestock from depredation of wolves. And that's due to the federal and the state listings. And so without those tools, that's why we ask for the compensation program. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Anyone else? Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Amaruk Weiss, and I'm the Director of Western Species Conservation for Defenders of Wildlife. I'd also like to make these remarks on behalf of Brett Brownscomb from Hells Canyon Preservation Council, who sat on the Wolf Advisory Committee with me as representatives and also participated in the meetings during the week of May 16th. The amendments that are presented to you in the Dash 5 are amendments that both Mr. Brownscomb and myself fully support. We have come a long way in this state from the first unconfirmed reported sightings of wolves in 98 to the first confirmed reported sightings of wolves in 1999. The federal process that ensued in bringing stakeholders together began in May of 1999. That was a meeting held in Bend, Oregon. I lived in California at the time. I specifically came up for that meeting because I realized, and defenders realized, the process that Oregon would be undergoing over the next 5, 10, however many years. That was the beginning. The Wolf Advisory Committee, the state process that the commission developed, we came a long way. A group of 14 stakeholders sat together and tried to work out their differences and their interests to be respected with regard to the wolf coming into the state. As this committee is probably aware, 12 of the 14 members did sign on with full support to that plan. Then the bill came out. Again, we've come a very long way. During the meetings that took place over the week of May 16th, the parties that you see before you, a few parties that aren't present at this table, wool growers specifically, also participated. We came a long way again, with all the parties meeting initially, having disagreements with the bill that had been introduced, and finding common meeting ground. The amendments that you see before you in the Dash 5s, we fully support. I will be addressing some separate comments with respect to the Dash 6, but want the committee to know that we do fully support what you see in front of you as Dash 5 amendments as the effort of this group.
Thank you. Tom, did you want to say anything?
For the record, Al Elkins, Oregon Hunters Association. We too appreciate the coming together of the work group. We agree. We had 25 points that we discussed. We agreed to 24 of them. All of those 24 are in the Dash 5s. The 25th point is in the Dash 6 amendments. We appreciate the hard work of the group and are supportive of the Dash 5s.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Cannon?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, Representative Beaufort. Okay. Go ahead, okay. Representative Beaufort.
Amaruk, I have some questions for Defenders of Wildlife. And I'm picking on you because I'm going to save my questions for Fish and Wildlife until the director comes up. I'd like to hear what the federal. So, don't take it wrong here. I have a list of questions, and you just happen to be the one landmark. You said in your testimony that you fully support the Dash 5 amendment. You have a Dash 6 amendment, I think, that comes from yourselves completely. And I just want you to kind of restate your total support for the Wolf Plan as it came out of the Wolf Task Force Committee and as was adopted by the Commission. Your organization locally in Oregon is fully supportive of it.
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, not only is my organization locally supportive of the Wolf Plan, my organization at the national level is supportive of the Wolf Plan. I can assure you that the decisions that were made by defenders in supporting the terms of the Wolf Plan and the process were with full consultation with our staff back in D.C.
The follow-up answer. I appreciate that, and from our perspective, given the other species that we've had and other agreements with other organizations, and the experience of this committee of the first amendment of the first bill that came forward, one of the concerns I have is that your organization or other organizations that support this plan today, 3 weeks from now, will be filing in court against it. Can you dispel my concerns in any way?
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, I'll certainly attempt to. Defenders of Wildlife has been present in this state for approximately 25 years. We have an office in West Lynn that has worked extensively with agriculture, timber, industry. For the last three legislative sessions, we have worked in partnership with those entities, particularly focusing on conservation incentives for private landowners. That has resulted in the last two legislative sessions in the enactment of two bills that provide non-regulatory, voluntary options for private landowners to do good things for wildlife and protect biodiversity. This current session, we have a bill pending in the Senate related to conservation easements. We have a very long history in this state of working together with stakeholders to provide common sense, common base solutions, and that is our preferred method of operating. When we have sued federal or state agencies, it has been when there has been a gross dereliction of duty in the enactment, in the following, in the administration of federal or state laws. I don't expect to see that happen in this state. I don't expect to see this state engage in gross dereliction of duty. Everything I've seen so far in this state suggests to me that Oregon is a creative, practical, solution-based state that brings parties together and likes to bring parties together. That is our preferred method of operating. I don't know if that assures you or not, but that is our history. That is our history in the state. That is our history nationwide. We have a reputation as a pragmatic and politically realistic group.
One more follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up, Madam Chair. As you mentioned, Oregon is creative, and this is going to be the first time, I think, that we've taken a public policy position if we were to adopt this on this type of compensation plan. And could you specifically, I know you run compensation plans in other states, and the compensation plan is a challenge in this state. And we've heard the number several times, you know, whether it's your organization or not, has said, you know, someone's willing to put up $200,000 to help start a compensation plan. What exactly is your organization willing to do in the compensation area and willing to commit to?
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, our compensation program, named the Bailey Wildlife Foundation Wolf Compensation Trust, is named specifically after the largest donor to that program, and we do have a separate trust for grizzly depredations. Let's just talk about the Wolf Trust. That was established in 1987. Originally was used in the Northern Rockies. When wolf recovery efforts began in the Southwest, we extended our compensation fund to that region. When Wolf B-45 from Idaho made her confirmed appearance in Oregon, at that time we issued a press release indicating that we were expanding our Wolf Compensation Trust availability to Oregon and other states where wolves from the Northern Rockies population could disperse. So, in fact, since 1999, our compensation fund has been available in the state of Oregon. No one has come forward to make any claims. Similarly, in 1999, we established the Bailey Wildlife Foundation Proactive Carnivore Conservation Fund. This is a separate fund that is used to cost share the implementation of non-lethal methods with livestock producers in the various states where wolves are to prevent wolf-livestock conflicts. What that results in the long run, is paying less compensation because you've actually done the proactive work to begin with. Better yet, it saves both livestock and wolves, which becomes a win-win for people on the livestock end and people on the conservation end that want to see wolves stay alive. As far as administration of it, again, it's currently available in Oregon. One of the things that came up in the Wolf Advisory Committee and the reason that the group and the plan decided to recommend a state-run fund was that Defenders of Wildlife has never said that we would carry that fund into perpetuity. Our mission is to protect endangered and threatened species and the habitats upon which they depend. We've always said that we will maintain the fund, the compensation fund, as long as the wolf is federally listed. We have not said that we will not continue it beyond then. We're looking to see what happens. We're looking kind kind of at the state domain. We're looking at the state planning process. We recently did a survey of our Northern Rockies ranchers who had received compensation over the last 3 years to find out whether or not having the compensation fund actually promoted their tolerance for living with wolves. And we found that about 70% of them said their tolerance for living with wolves would be decreased if the compensation fund did not exist. About 60% of them in the survey also indicated they'd be interested in getting more information from us on how to do proactive partnerships to implement non-lethal. So we are finding that for conserving an endangered species and reaching a goal that everybody wants to reach, I think everyone here wants to reach the goal of achieving a recovery process that gets the wolf off the federal list, that eventually gets the wolf off the state list, and what that requires with this particular species is social tolerance. That is what it requires. Wolves can live anywhere people will tolerate them. But if people don't tolerate them, you'll never get to your conservation goals. So we have discovered that this is a win-win for both sides at the table, and I think that you will find in Oregon the same thing would be true. I will note that the other conservation rep and I on the Wolf Advisory Committee were a little leery of the state starting its own fund, and I think perhaps we had some of the same concerns that you did. Not because we don't think it's valuable for livestock producers and for wolves. It's immensely valuable. We recognize the point that has been raised that this is a first for Oregon. One of the things that we decided to do in the Wolf Advisory Committee was to therefore establish this as a joint state and privately run fund. And it would include not only compensation for losses, but it would also include funding to implement non-lethal means. That's really the secret to the success of what is in the Wolf Plan as a compensation and proactive fund.
Thank you. I'm going to have to move on. Representative Grogan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is kind of a question to each one of you, and I'd just like to get kind of on record as to why your organizations would rather have this, the Dash 5s and this bill, than not have anything.
For the record, Al Elkins, Oregon Hunters Association. The board of directors of the Oregon Hunters Association 2 years ago started with a position that they did not want wolves in Oregon, period. They discussed that for a while and decided that that was not as realistic as probably stand as it should be. And they understood that wolves were going to come into Oregon eventually. And many of the hunters that I've talked to say they're already here. So then we had to look at what the next step was in the process. And they assumed, their assumption that there were going to be wolves in Oregon meant that we had to do something in terms of managing them or try to manage them, because we have real concerns about herds of deer and elk, obviously. And so we were part of, the hunters were represented, not Oregon Hunters Association, but hunters were represented on the Wolf Committee, and we tried to get the best management plan we possibly could. They are reluctant to say that in some respects that they support a plan and the Dash 5s, but in their hearts they know they have to have a management tool of some sort. Without the Dash 5s and without the plan, we have no management tool to take care of a situation that's coming sometime in the future. So that's where they are essentially today. They're, you know, it's like bringing a child to the table and telling them to sit down and eat. They've been through that process. They're doing that. They don't like the taste of the broccoli, but they're going to eat it anyway. So that's where we are.
Chair Smith, Representative Roblin, for Farm Bureau, it is a similar situation with the hunters. If we like it or not, Oregon will be having wolves migrate from Idaho and other areas into Oregon and set up populations. Our membership can be given tools to help deal with the wolves. Our Fish and Wildlife Department can be given tools to help the hunter associations, the farmers, and the conservation community manage wolves, or we can sit back and allow the federal government to manage them. And for us, we would rather be proactive and have the state involved in some of the management decisions and management choices, and some legal tools given to the ranching community besides shoot, shovel, and shut up. And that's where it comes down for Farm Bureau. And it's something that we've been, I think, struggling with, and the question that we've been answering for several months and probably, you know, for the year or so that the wolf planning has gone through.
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, I think a more eloquent answer you'll hear from Lindsey Ball in the next panel, but I think from the agency's perspective, it's our commitment that, you know, the state manages fish and wildlife, and if wolves are going to be back as part of the fish and wildlife regime of the state of Oregon, then they need to be managed by the state of Oregon, and landowners need tools to protect their property. Conservationists need to feel that wolves are being managed, so they're part of the state management regime. And I guess in short then, if you don't have a plan, you really have chaos. And so it's only really development of plan that the state can actually manage and take over management of wolves like they manage the rest of the wildlife in the state, and that's the role. And any other comments, I'll let Lindsey comment on that for you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, Mr. Elkins, Ms. Fast, and Mr. Elliker have already said everything I would need to say as to why we support this bill and these amendments.
Thank you. Representative Burley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Elkins, I'm glad you pointed out the issue. I mean, we focus a lot on livestock and landowners and whatnot, but I think the big game is also of great concern here. March-April 2005, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation Bugle publication reported that the northern Yellowstone elk herd has dropped from 19,000 in 1994 to 9,545 in January of this year. And the biologists attribute most of that to intense predation by wolves, grizzly, and mountain lions, along with drought and some other conditions. And I think we need to keep that in focus here as we're having this debate as well. Ms. Weiss, I guess my concern is your organization was a plaintiff in the lawsuit that Judge Jones decided on January 31st. Five issues were raised. I guess my question is, if this legislation passes and this plan is implemented and the compensation fund is funded and everything's, you know, on track, I'm looking for assurance that you're not going to do it again. I mean, you talk about it, but I guess, you know, under ESA, talking about these issues, especially distinct population segments and whatnot, you know, we don't have years and years and years to wait to work this out. So how will your organization, if this thing moves forward, help expedite the downlisting and eventual delisting here in the state of Oregon?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I hear a lot of concern coming from you regarding this issue, and it's not the first time I've heard it. So I'm hopeful that my response will assure you. When the federal lawsuit was filed, this was after years of working with the federal government trying to dissuade them from going down the route that they went. We weren't the only ones that tried to dissuade them. Two previous federal court cases had ruled on the exact same issue against the service, against their interpretation of what constituted a significant portion of range when looking at conservation and recovery of a listed species. In one case, the lynx, in the other case, the flat-tailed horned lizard. The service was very much on notice that the route that they were taking, and we encouraged them very much to depart from that route for years. In 1998, we published a publication, Places for Wolves, that indicated what conservation would look like under the guidance of the federal ESA. We submitted public comments. We engaged in lengthy discussions with them. When we filed the lawsuit, we first filed an initial 60-day notice of intent to sue, again giving them an opportunity to revisit all the evidence that had been put before them as to why this was the wrong track legally. In the state of Oregon, Defenders has participated as a member of stakeholder groups since 1999 when B-45 came across. In fact, Defenders of Wildlife and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service together co-sponsored the first stakeholders meeting. We have been intimately involved in the process, first with my colleague Suzanne Stone, based in Idaho. Then I became involved. We have been actively involved in consulting with all the other stakeholders in this group. It is our view that wildlife should be managed by the state. It's really an aberration when wildlife is managed by the federal government. When that happens, it's because it's federally listed and because the species doesn't know boundaries. It is our goal to see state plans such as Oregon's be implemented, and in fact, we think that Oregon's plan is such a good plan, we are holding it out as a model to other states to follow. We do not intend to sue.
Follow up? You know, part of the problem, I guess, if I understand this, Oregon is part of the, and I may get this name wrong, but the Western States Distinct Population Segment, which is obviously more than just the state of Oregon. It's, I guess, all of them west of the Mississippi, or whatever number it is. And my inquiries with folks is, you know, can we, if this plan is implemented in the state of Oregon, can we get it downlisted in Oregon right away? And the answer is no, because we have to deal with a whole distinct population segment based on Judge Jones's decision. So, A, you know, is your interpretation of this correct? And B, if so, how can we get it in Oregon, if this plan's implemented, how can we get it downlisted in Oregon irrespective of the other states? We had the 4D rule. We had the state control at one point. But your lawsuit took that away from us. So how do we get it back in Oregon?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, the issue of the distinct population segments is actually a policy of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service designed to distinguish vertebrate populations in different parts of the country in terms of whether or not they are endangered in one part versus not endangered in another, threatened in one part versus not threatened in another. One of the basis for the lawsuit was that the Western Distinct Population Segment was a grouping of nine states, even though only three of those states had wolves in them. Similarly, the Eastern Distinct Population Segment was a grouping of 21 states, even though there were only wolves in three of those states. My understanding is that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and perhaps they'll be able to respond to your question when they're up here, is reexamining how they might want to do distinct population segments in this country that better reflect where wolves are and where recovery is actually happening.
Thank you. Representative Sumner, you know, questions? Okay. Did you want to explain the Dash 6 very quickly while you're here?
Sure.
Because I need to move on to the other panel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as indicated, we do fully support the Dash 5s. I would like to note that Dash 6 is proposed not only by Defenders of Wildlife, but also by Hell's Canyon Preservation Council. So please, if you could make that note. Our Dash 6s, I guess, duplicate the Dash 5s, but beyond that, if you could turn to page 5 of the Dash 6s.
Yeah. Okay. We got it.
Okay. Starting at line 26, we would request the addition of the following language. It's one long sentence. If upon review of the population status of the gray wolf, or if alerted by the department, the commission determines that the gray wolf population in Oregon is at risk of failing to meet the conservation population objectives specified by the commission in administrative rule, and that lethal take is responsible for that condition, the commission shall amend its rules to reduce the lethal taking of gray wolves. Prior to entering into the negotiations last week, there was previously a permit requirement for take of a wolf caught in the act on public land while the wolf is still state listed. In the course of the negotiations, that permit requirement disappeared. Mm-hmm. Hell's Canyon Preservation Council and Defenders of Wildlife believes that as stewards of the state's wildlife, the state, the commission, must still have the authority to act by statute to amend its rules if it turns out that lethal take is resulting in the wolf population not being able to get to delisting. That, again, is a goal that we all have in mind. And we don't anticipate that take of wolves from caught in the act is going to be so much the source of the problem, and we're not interested in taking that right away from landowners and from people that are grazing. What we are concerned about is if there is a level of illegal poaching that it turns out is causing so much lethal take that the wolf population can't even get to its conservation goals and we can't get to delisting, we need the state to be able to step back in to do something. Amending its rules to reduce lethal take doesn't necessarily mean halting all lethal take. It's in the plan on page 30, and I would refer you to there. There's all kinds of things the commission could do. They could increase the presence of law enforcement in areas where they believe illegal poaching is taking place. They could increase the penalties for illegal poaching. They could reinstitute a permit requirement, but without this authority to act, there is nothing in here that tells the state that it has an obligation to do something in order to get the species off the list. We're asking that this go into the language along with the dash fives.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? No. Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We go to Kemper McMaster from the U.S. Force Fish and Wildlife and Lindsay Ball, our Director of Oregon Fish and Wildlife.
What you need is name like Kemper.
Thank you and good morning and making the trip here. As you can see, we had a lot of questions. So did you want to say anything before we open up to questions?
Yes, ma'am. I have a brief statement, and Director Ball has provided copies to committee assistant, which I believe are being handed out.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Smith and members of the committee. I am Kemper McMaster, State Supervisor of the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Office, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Portland, Oregon. I am pleased to appear before you today to discuss Oregon's Wolf Conservation and Management Plan and to attempt to answer your questions on how it relates to the Endangered Species Act. First off, I'd like to provide a little background. The gray wolf was listed as an endangered species in the original Act of 1973. In the mid-80s, wolves started recolonizing south of Canada, naturally recolonizing south of Canada into northwest Montana. And in approximately 1985, the first pack was established in Glacier National Park. In May of 1987, I arrived in Helena, Montana as the supervisor of the Montana-Wyoming Fish and Wildlife Office, very similar office to or position to which I now hold. 7 days after my arrival, still extremely green, trying to learn which way is up in a brand new job, we had our first depredation on livestock outside Glacier National Park. These two facts, one, that wolves are naturally recolonizing portions of their range as a fully listed endangered species, and that management of these recolonizing wolves was essential, provided the impetus for what became the experimental population and the reintroduction efforts in Yellowstone and central Idaho. The basis for the experimental population was not only to promote the conservation and accelerated recovery of the gray wolf in the Rocky Mountain region, but also to provide the management flexibility that was essential to successful management of the species. While certainly not without problems, the experimental population and accompanying fully listed population in northwest Montana have exceeded expectations in terms of recovery. At the end of 2004, the service estimated there were a total of 835 wolves, constituting 66 breeding pairs within the recovery area of Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. 2004 constituted the fifth year in which 30 or more breeding pairs were documented in the Northern Rocky Mountain recovery area. The service believed and still believes that this constitutes a viable recovered population in the Northwest. However, delisting has been delayed for several reasons, including state laws and wolf management plans that would reasonably assure the gray wolf would not become a threatened or endangered species are not in place within the recovery area. And the January 31, 2005 Oregon District Court ruling vacated the distinct population segment analysis that we used to promote the downlisting and the 4D rule. That brings us today, and the Oregon Wolf Conservation and Recovery Plan. With that brief introduction, I'd be happy to answer any of your questions. Thank you.
Mr. Ball, did you want to add anything?
Chair Smith, members of the committee, my name is Lindsay Ball. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I have no specific comments. I think with the time remaining, it would be best used for questions of Mr. McMaster.
Thank you. Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kemper, thanks for coming today, and it's good to see you again. I think the last time you and I met, it was actually at a meeting with B-45 when she was over here in Oregon.
Could have met.
Help us, please, understand, and again, I really appreciate you coming, because a lot of these questions, you know, we've asked Director Ball, and it, you know, you're a partner in this thing, so what exactly is the service doing now in light of Judge Jones' decision, especially especially with respect to the distinct population segments. You heard me asking earlier about trying to get distinct downlisted and delisted in Oregon. What are you doing in that respect?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, unfortunately, I cannot tell you exactly what the Department of Justice nor the Department of Interior or the service in D.C. is doing with response to the next steps in the lawsuit. And that's being discussed, handled, and decided by levels far superior to me. The center part of your question that resonates with me is delisted in Oregon. The law does not allow us to delist by state boundary. We can list or delist by species, subspecies, or distinct population of vertebrate species. That's the DPS terminology that we have all become familiar with. What I mean by that is the entire gray wolf could be delisted. If a subspecies were designated, which it is not, we could delist by subspecies, the range of that subspecies, or we could delist by the demarcations of a distinct vertebrate population. But unless that boundary happened to coincidentally coincide with a state boundary, we would not be able to delist just in Oregon.
Thank you. Is Minnesota a distinct population segment? Because if I'm not mistaken, that's threatened, yet it's endangered elsewhere.
As I recall, Madam Chair, Representative Burley, as I recall, that was in the original listing process. Population, to use that term not specifically or not scientifically, in the Great Lakes was always doing significantly better than, in fact, they were present when wolves were not present anywhere else in the lower 48.
Thank you. Director Ball has shared with us the communications between his office and your office, which we're greatly appreciative of. A lot of options seem to be floating around. We've got under ESA the Section 10A1A. There's also, if I'm not mistaken, 10A1B, which I think is where incidental take statements are given, typically with HCPs, habitat conservation plans. 10J, the experimental population. And I think even under Section 6, where there's opportunities for cooperative agreements between the states and the federal government, these are all viable options. What are the pros and cons of them, and what kind of timelines are we looking at under those different options?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I think you touched on, if not all, at least the vast majority of the options available to us. Section 10A1A is a permitting process for recovery. It is to promote the conservation and recovery of listed species. It is often granted for research purposes or propagation where take could occur during that conservation effort. And that is a process that we are actively discussing with the state to pursue development of a Section 10A1A permit. Section 10A1B is another permitting process, as you said, normally used through habitat conservation plans. An example of that would be something like a timber company wanting to engage in otherwise lawfully present activities such as managing timber, but for the presence of an endangered species or listed species such as, the northern spotted owl or the marbled murrelet, the entity would develop a plan that would allow their economic interest to move forward while also promoting the continued existence and hopefully recovery of the listed species. It is the difference between 10A1A and the B is one more based on, I would say, the recovery permit is exactly what it says. It is to promote the conservation and recovery of a listed species. The 10A1B is take is going to occur, and we're trying to minimize it to the maximum extent practicable. So one's promotion of conservation, attainment of recovery, attainment of delisting, and the other one is more or less trying to prevent a worsening of the situation. while still allowing for a recovery to occur. Section 10J is the experimental population process that was used in Yellowstone and central Idaho. That is a as I'm sure you know, a very lengthy formal rulemaking process. I think it took us about 5 years to get through the entire process for Yellowstone and central Idaho, including the studies that were mandated by Congress ahead of time. The Section 6 agreement, which we currently have with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, also with Oregon Department of State Lands and Agriculture, is a process whereby state agencies and Fish and Wildlife Service can engage in cooperative projects, cooperatively funded projects at times, and the through that process, through that cooperative agreement, the state, ODF&W, has the authority to engage in certain management activities for listed species. Those would include things like non-lethal take, harassment, those sorts of things.
Under Section 6, is the Fish and Wildlife Service authorized to help pay for some of these management activities in the state?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, yes, we are. The short answer is yes, we are. It would the process would be that the state would put in an application or a project. It would be ranked against their other projects, and both by the state itself. This was our first priority, our second priority, whatever. It would go through a review process within the service, and that those that were funded, there's a certain amount of money in Section 6, then they would receive money through that project.
Recently, Interior Secretary Norton approved some new rules in Montana and Idaho, giving landowners, producers, etc., more flexibility with dealing with this, including the authorization to for lethal take immediately by landowners, permittees, guides, outfitters, etc. I'm not going to read this whole list, but you know, are these types of rules possible in the state of Oregon now, or what would we have to do to get to that point where we could have these same types of rules that they've got in Montana and Idaho now?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I was not aware that lethal take by private individuals had been authorized. With that aside, the Section 10A1A process is a permitting process by which the service could grant to the state of Oregon the vast majority of the management options that are available within their management plan. The one area where our legal counsel says that we are not able to go is granting lethal take to individuals. We would be able to grant to Oregon the ability to use for them to engage in lethal take, as well as all the stuff that would lead up to that, the non-lethal harassment, possible relocation, all of the other conservation measures. But under the 10A1A process, we could grant to the state the ability to take wolves.
One last question. So just to be real clear, under 10A1A, the state could have the lethal take authority, but an individual would not. And which to me is kind of getting the ball across the 50-yard line. To me, getting the ball across the goal line means that we have to get the animal downlisted in the state of Oregon, not throughout whatever distinct population segment you end up defining. And so my question is, how do we get past the 10A1A 50-yard line? How do we get all the way to the goal line and get this thing downlisted so we can have the 4D rule again and get that incidental take statement so we can have the lethal take by the landowner and the private individual without their being prosecuted under the federal ESA?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, the way we get there, in my opinion, is that both the states within the designated recovery area and those that are adjacent to them do exactly what Oregon is doing. And while a plan in Oregon is not a federal requirement, it is not part of the recovery plan, it's not something that we say has to get done, it is that extra level of conservation that I think is essential to promoting the conservation of gray wolf and getting us to a point where we can downlist and delist.
So that puts us at the mercy of the other states.
To a degree, yes, sir.
Thank you. What's my focus?
I'm sure, thank you. Kevin, I really appreciate you coming, because shedding light on the keys. He said this, they said that, and I'm a simple farmer. I'm one of those that has a piece of property that frankly has wolves already close to it. So there are real issues at hand that are personal. We're talking about the Oregon Wolf Conservation and Recovery Plan, which has already gone through a year through of committee meetings and has already been adopted by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. As that plan sits today, and I know you're familiar with it, can you give me just a brief summary? As the plan sits today, without any other action, is it a good plan? Is it the type of plan you're talking about? Your thoughts on the plan itself.
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, it is an outstanding plan. I think it goes well beyond a minimalist plan that some folks have advocated. Is a plan that when implemented, either to the 90% or to the 100% level, will promote the conservation and recovery of the gray wolf in Oregon, which will provide a fundamental building block to the conservation and recovery of the gray wolf in whatever the DPS turns out to be. I believe it's an outstanding plan.
Yes.
The interpretation, there were quite a bit of discussion, you may or may not know, of you know, how do you classify the wolf? And I think the latest amendment is they're going to classify it as a game mammal, which is not exactly what I would call it. I mean, what's your thought on whether it's a special species or whether it should be classified as a game mammal, or any comments on that? I mean, game mammal to me seems like that's something you hunt, and I don't think in my lifetime we're going to be hunting wolves.
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, I am not familiar with the technical difference between the terms you used. I believe that state wildlife agencies are the proper entity to be managing resident wildlife within the state, be that Oregon, Idaho, Montana, wherever. I believe the classification as a game animal, along with deer, elk, chukar, pheasant, whatever, I think the success of the state agencies, not just Oregon, but all of them, in managing resident wildlife is evidence of is evidenced by the fact that we have the populations of wildlife that we have today. So I believe it's an, again, I do not know the technical difference between the terms you use, but management by the state, once it has passed the threshold of the ESA, management by the state, by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is the appropriate, that's where it belongs. And to add to that, and it will require management, as I learned very early in my position in Helena.
Yes.
Just one final question. Are you aware of any place in the federal system that they're paying compensation for wolves or livestock damage at this point, or is it purely out in the private sector and the state's paying compensation?
Madam Chair, I am not aware of a state paying it. Since the very early days of wolf recovery in Montana, the Defenders of Wildlife Program has been paying compensation, and that was a foundation. I believe there were two things that really made wolf recovery or conservation in Montana possible, and that was the fact that the federal agencies, Wildlife Services and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, walked our talk in terms of controlling wolves. We exercised lethal control on the second pack to show up in Montana. That was the one on the east side of Glacier, because they were behaving in a manner that was not conducive to the conservation and recovery of gray wolves in the West. And the other fact, the foundation block, was the defenders walked their talk. They said they would pay for depredations. They developed a very fair, equitable program, and I do not have the numbers, but it paid out a substantial amount of dollars to cover livestock losses.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? I'm just kind of curious what the first incident of depredation, livestock depredation, that you faced from wolves in Montana. You've talked about that several times. What was that?
We had, Madam Chair, a newly formed pack moving out of Glacier Park onto the east side. It was called the Browning Pack, I believe, and it was involved. Memory's failing me as to remember the rancher's name, but it was involved both sheep and cattle, just outside Browning, Montana. I'd be happy to get specifics for you.
Kind of scared of those critters. Thank you. Any other questions before we let
Representative? One more. I'm still thinking about the last comment about how we're kind of at the mercy of the other states. Kemper, if this legislation is not passed, and Director Ball, the plan to some extent could still be implemented, if I'm not mistaken. But in your opinion, Kemper, where would that leave us? In contrast, where we'd be if we did pass it? I mean, what would be the difference? If we can't do anything until Washington and everybody else adopts similar plans, why?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, the service still believes that the designated Rocky Mountain Wolf Recovery Area, Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, is sufficient to move toward downlisting and delisting. How that winds its way through the courts or the policy level entities within the department, within my agency and Interior, I can't speak to. But as far as I am aware today, we still maintain that the three states, Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, at the levels specified in the recovery plan are sufficient to move forward with downlisting and delisting. One of the elements within Section 4 of the ESA, which drives both listing and delisting, is an element that says adequate regulatory mechanisms must, and I'm paraphrasing grossly, adequate regulatory mechanisms must be in place so that when you delist, it can protect the species so it doesn't have to be automatically relisted. The plans that we have referred to in Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho are the core of that adequate regulatory mechanism. I believe plans such as Oregon's in the surrounding states are additive to that. They provide additional above the requirement to promote the conservation and recovery and ensure that we have met the adequate regulatory mechanism standard within Section 4 of the ESA. So, at the mercy of, I don't know that I would use your terminology, somewhat joined at the hip, yes, sir, I believe we are. Wildlife do not observe the boundaries that we draw on maps. And as to why you would want to empower the state, I have a five-person staff in LeGrand. We're involved in a variety of activities. Director Ball is, and his agency is much better situated to meet the needs of the citizens of Oregon than I am. And I boil it down to very simple: do you want the feds in charge, or do you want your guys in charge? And even as being one of the feds, I vote for the state. As I said before, I believe they are the appropriate professional management agency to manage wildlife, even while listed, to the maximum extent that we can permit through law. I believe they're the right people to have in charge.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. That leads me to one question then. If you prefer the state to manage them, it would cost the state rather than the federal. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, it yes.
Right. And that's a federal wolf that's coming into Oregon.
It is a federal listed species. Yes, ma'am.
you. I have one question for Director Ball. We can't manage cougars in this state. How are we going to manage wolves?
Chair Smith, in some people's eyes, we're managing wolves or cougars very successfully. We have more now than ever.
Yeah. And is that what we're going to have with wolves? More.
Chair Smith, humor aside, I think there's a couple things that have dictated how cougar are managed, and that was an initiative petition. And also other constraints placed on how wolves or cougars were managed, 30 and 40 years ago compared to how they are today. So I think what we have to do with cougar is become a little more creative and create a management scheme for cougar, such as you and I have talked about. And
I'm not sure we use the word scheme. I'm just kidding.
Well, well, probably didn't use the word scheme. Yeah. Thanks for the correction. But I think in my position with respect to cougars, we have to start managing the cougar population in Oregon better than what we have today. We're reaching the point, as what you've heard many times over, the numbers of cougar in Oregon are becoming socially unacceptable. And quite frankly, we need the tools to deal with that. Now, is today the time?
Right.
I think we should start forging ahead with more extensive cougar efforts, cougar management efforts. And I also feel that, like the cougar, we also need to form a management plan for wolves. Both species bring their own set of problems to our citizens, and citizens deserve service from their government. And where we can help that, I think we should be actively pursuing it.
I think that's what we all face as a policy committee. We're struggling with the same issues. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you. I have one more panel to go. Glenn Stonebrink, Oregon Cattlemen's. Would you like to come up? We have one more bill to hear, so thanks.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you for allowing me to testify. Glenn Stonebridge for the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. And Chair Smith, I was concentrating on something else, and I heard just briefly something you mentioned that the media had made a statement that a committee was meeting in secret or something. If I have said anything or put anything out in print that may have led to that conclusion.
No, that was a different issue.
I apologize. So,
that was a totally different issue. Thank you very much, though.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll blame you for it.
Okay, I apologize.
We'll look at that.
Well, I have said some things about in my testimony there under alienation because of the situation with the work group that was put together, and I know it was not a sanctioned work group put together by this committee, or no members of the committee served on it. But I the fact that the Oregon Cattlemen, the Oregon State Grange, and the Oregon Women for Agriculture, and the county government folks who were very involved with the whole process, the planning process, testified in the planning process, etc., that we were not included in that group that met for what I've understood for 5 days. In fact, we didn't know anything about it before, during, or after until Craig Ely from the Department of Fish and Wildlife brought me a draft of amendments. And I have to assume that those draft amendments are what you see in Dash 5, because I have not had time to analyze Dash 5 whatsoever. I hope that in considering those amendments and what time I have to analyze these, I'm going to give you my opinion of it just briefly. But first, I'd like to touch on just a couple things that you've just heard from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on the wolf. And in fact, I guess I would have to say that, is there a rush to pass this legislation? Is there a need to pass it immediately? I don't think so. I think there were 16 members of the House, and I'm sure there would have been more if there had been more time, that sent a letter to the Fish and Wildlife Commission asking them to hold off on their plan and their rules, especially because you folks were in session. Five of the people who signed that letter are on this committee. And actually, looking for clarity in what the downlisting might have meant, the lawsuit might have meant, et cetera. And I also noticed that Fish and Wildlife, Mr. McMaster, talked about the wolf plan as a wolf conservation and recovery. And the word recovery is important. And I will get into that just a little bit later on. You notice that they do not allow, one of the things they mentioned, that they would not allow for an individual, meaning what I understand as an individual be as a livestock producer, to take. And yet that's one of the things that's being played up quite largely in the Dash 5 amendments, and I will again talk about that in just a moment. This wolf plan and this legislation was also addressed by Mr. McMaster as an additive to Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho and their plans. And I have to ask you, at our time of financial situation, an additive and at what cost? And I know you have the plans in front of you, and I don't know if you've had much chance to look at them, but the costs are spelled out by the plan itself. You know, over $500,000 has been spent. Expect to spend at least another $500,000 every year. And so you can see what the cost might be. If you buy this notion that's been sold a number of times by a number of people, is it better for the state to manage the wolves than the federal government? And the answer seems to always come back, it's better for the state to be managing. And managing how? Under the plan, under the rules, and this legislation. Then please study the plan. The plan is full of words, 178 pages of words. And those words really do mean something. And Chair Smith, you mentioned that if they really can't manage the cougar, then how can they manage the wolf? The plan will tell you how they will manage the wolf. It is very, very important that you understand what's in the plan. I will just touch on some of it today because I know we don't have time to cover it all. I would love to, but I will with you individually if you like. Just to the amendments of the Dash 5 that were promoted by the working group, they do nothing to make this legislation better for livestock producers. In fact, they make it worse. Let me tell you why. Here's a real simple one. In earlier hearings, the Oregon cattlemen objected to the language on page 5, line 19, that referring to compensation for livestock losses on private land or on, quote, on public land under a legal grazing right. And the reason we objected to that was because we didn't think it was a role for the Department of Fish and Wildlife to get into the business of determining what's a legal grazing right or what's not a legal grazing right. So the amendment deletes those words on public land under illegal grazing rights and replaces it with legally grazing on public lands. Okay? It's the same thing. So it may look like an amendment to help, but it's the same thing. To the new amendments, the Dash 5s on page 4, line 24 to 27, this is the one that they claim that livestock producers would be able to kill wolves to defend their livestock. Once again, this is not true. They say that, and it looks like that when you look at it, but it's not true. Because if you look at what it says is that if the person is the landowner or lawful occupant, or if the person has in the person's possession written authority from the landowner or lawful occupant of the land. Number three, the incident is reported within 24 hours. The scene of the take is not disturbed and is preserved, and no evidence of wolf baiting or other intentional act to attract and kill wolves is presented. This does not include the mere existence of or presence of livestock. Now, you want to notice that take has to occur while the wolf was, quote, caught in the act of attacking. caught in the act of attacking. What do you visualize when you see that? Their rules that they've already written and approved means, and you, I have them here, and I gave them to you earlier. But the rules already passed by the commission says this does not mean testing or scavenging, and that there must be physical wounds and tracks demonstrating that a chase occurs. So I don't know what caught really means. I can only visualize it by what I might see on TV. If you could take a video camera and then you could stop it at a certain moment and say, there's the moment that you could kill the wolf. They would not let you, if it's testing or chasing, that's not caught in the act of killing. Now, we had documented case where a rancher and others observed a cow with its baby calf being harassed, if you will, by wolves. And that cow went into such a frenzy trying to chase off those wolves time and time and time again. And the wolves kept just circling and making fake attacks and so on until her lungs actually burst, filled with blood, and she drowned in her own blood. In that situation and other situations of chasing, you could not kill a wolf because it has not actually caught in the act of killing, of attacking. And then once the wolf has made the kill, if you didn't catch it at that moment and the animal's dead and you caught it a few moments afterwards, even if you'd seen it from afar, you couldn't kill the wolf because now it's scavenging. So what did that really do for the rancher? Nothing but add confusion and thinking that maybe you could actually kill a wolf. Then it says you cannot, the scene again, the take cannot be disturbed, must be preserved. And as I pointed out in my earlier testimony, what happens if some other animal or some other thing disturbs this scene? Is the rancher then found guilty of making an illegal take? And then they added some new words here about wolf baiting. And I don't know what that means. There's no definition of this, so I guess it could mean anything to anybody. We objected to, on page 3, line 38, we objected to the special status of for the wolf. The working group under dash 5s, they removed the special status classification for the gray wolf. That's true. But they replaced it with, the commission shall establish special management regulations for the gray wolf. Doesn't that sound like the same thing? Well, it is, except that it went from may establish to shall establish. This is supposed to help livestock producers? I don't think so. I asked Mr. Ely from Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, what was discussed when they were talking about this amendment on special status? And he said there wasn't. So someone, I don't know who, proposed this language, and it was adopted by the group. So if I, you know, I assume Mr. Ely's honest, and he was the only one, by the way, that brought forth any of these amendments to allow us, and I shared them then with the Grange and with the Oregon Women for Agriculture. Otherwise, we wouldn't have seen these amendments until today. So I'd have to believe him that there was no discussion by that work group. And the reason that's important is because I have, and I've made no bones about it, I've been very skeptical of the words in the plan and the rules and this legislation that really mean something important. And to slip this in, I think someone got duped. I'll just move on.
Can you kind of wind down because we need to move on to our other hearing?
Kind of wind down. Where do I stop? I know you have.
I know you're opposed to this.
Okay. Could you tell me about how much time I have, and then I'll figure out.
5 minutes, because I want to leave some time for questions.
Okay. In at the bottom of my second or third page, I guess it is. The plan, and I know I won't have time to go through all of this, but in the plan on page small I V, you will see these are the words of the commission. This is the executive summary. This is what they are telling all of you that this plan means. that the plan was built to meet the five delisting criteria identified in the state statutes and the administrative rules, which, of course, they write the administrative rules. And if you go through these, let me go through the first one. It says the species is not now and is not likely in the foreseeable future to be in danger of extinction in any significant portion of its range in Oregon or in danger of becoming endangered. Now, just a moment ago, some of you were asking Defenders of Wildlife, well, you're in your lawsuit, and their lawsuit was based upon the fact that that they had downlisted the gray wolf, and they said, but it's not recovered significantly everywhere. Okay? What does this say? The species is not now and is not likely in the foreseeable future to be endangered of extinction in any significant portion of its range in Oregon. Now, what does the plan, as you go through the rest of the plan, what does it say about Oregon? That wolves are to be everywhere. So you cannot, this plan is, you could never delist the wolf. You will find some place, I guarantee you, and there will be a lawsuit, I guarantee you, if the wolf is not in everyone's backyard, and virtually could be in everyone's backyard, but somewhere between Burns and Wagon Tire, there may not be wolves out there in the sagebrush, and you couldn't delist. So, anyway, and I go through the rest of that. It's over and over and over again. The five things they say you must meet, and notice the big little word at the end of each one of those, it says and. That means you must meet all five significantly and sufficiently, or you will never be able to do them. I would like to close with the fact, and on the back of the testimony that I gave you is a legislative counsel's opinion that was shared with me from Senator Farioli and Representative Krupp. And in that legislative opinion concerning the plan and the rules, I call it an illegal plan. And I will just read to you in a paraphrase that what legislative counsel stated. We believe that parts of the plan appear to be outside the intent and scope of the authority of the commission. And we also find that portions of the plan that allow the take of species conflict with federal law and thus the rules raise constitutional issues under the Supremacy Clause. Now, while I have made similar conclusions, but for different reasons, I think it simply points out that if we're looking at a plan and rules that have the air of being illegal or out of sorts, please let's get this whole thing put back together. There is no rush. You're all probably much better aware of the issues of the wolf and the wolf situation and the documents now than you were before the session started. If you have 2 years to absorb it and get some more input, I think you could do a lot better job than 3478. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Stoneberg? No questions. You must have done a great job. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we have your written testimony. Thank you. Committee, that concludes our panels on the House Bill 3478. I think what I want to do in light of, we've just gotten some amendments, the Dash 6 amendments, and you do have a summary of all the amendments other than the Dash 6. He does have it on here. Why don't you get back to me as the chair and tell me how you proceed this or which amendment you like, which one you don't like by amendments, and where you're at on the bill. And I would like that by tomorrow morning if I could. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing. House Bill 3478. And I do want to get Senator Deckard.
His staff is going to wait.
All right. We're waiting just a few minutes for Senator Deckard, and we'll start the other bill. So we'll stand at ease.
Thank you, Manager. I will. Senate Bill 844A creates a classification for dangerous dogs and potentially dangerous dogs and modifies the authority for law enforcement officers, dog control boards, county governments, and courts related to impoundment and disposition of dangerous dogs, potentially dangerous dogs, and dogs deemed to be a public nuisance. It directs counties to create registries for dogs determined to be dangerous and potentially dangerous, sets penalties for maintaining a dangerous or potentially dangerous dog, and modifies existing penalties for maintaining a dog that is deemed to be a public nuisance. Minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact on this bill. It was passed by the full Senate on a 23-4 vote.
Thank you very much. Well, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Representative Sumner, Representative Beyer, Vice Chair Boquist, Vice Chair Roblin, and Representative Haas. I am thrilled. I'm Ryan Deckert. From Beaverton and Aloha and Southwest Portland, and the room just cleared out. You must have had wolves.
We did.
Before the committee, because as I was walking in, I think about 100 people filed past me.
We go from wolves to dogs.
Well, hopefully, here's my hope, is that this will be an easier one. A great deal of work has gone into it. What we did is we introduced, and I've talked, I think, most of the members of this committee about this. We had some real tragic incidences throughout Oregon, and one that I'm very familiar with a woman who was driving by early in the morning, and she's not here to testify. She testified in the Senate, but it's one of those heroic stories that you come across where she sacrificed her own well-being and almost her life to protect a young boy, a 7-year-old boy, laid on top of them as he was being mauled, and her face was badly, badly damaged. That she lived and the boy lived, and it's one of those amazing, amazing stories that prompted many of us to ask, well, what could be improved in the legislation that we have? And what we found is as often is the case when you introduce legislation, is we made a run at it, talking to a few folks, and then a great deal of the community came out and said, well, we're really interested in getting something done too, but we'd like to perfect it. And one of the big issues that we had in the original bill was breed specificity, where we singled out certain breeds, which we think have been problematic. And what we learned is that, and that's what you see in the amended version of Senate Bill 844, is that we took that out and we had the behavior determine rather than the breed of the dog determine the penalty structure. So, Madam Chair, you have my written testimony. This is hopefully a consensus process. We and Susie, who does not want to testify, I was told, but really was, and I have to give her credit, she took the lead and got the work group together, and it was folks from the counties, Representative Soa, our former representative, County Commissioner Soa, represented the counties and the vets on it. We had folks from the Breeders Association, from the vets, had another representative in there, and the animal control to really get a consensus bill, and that's what we hope we've got before you. They had 2 or 3 long meetings and then subsequent meeting to really come up with, well, what would be a consensus product, and that's what hopefully we're bringing to you. The first part of it is strict liability, which just asks the owners of the dog to take a little bit more responsibility, but with the right tone to it, when they have what would be a potentially vicious or a dangerous dog. And then the second part of the bill is in the same vein, is it just tries to get at the behavior and let not just the owners but the community knows that we're going to keep an eye on these dogs, because it seems to be that there are certain dogs that over and over again are attacking, whether it's a woman's horse we heard about in Clackamas County, and Larry Sowell was very familiar with that case, or if it is a child, because that seems to be the two areas that are most often afflicted. And just talking to members of this committee, I heard several more stories of people, either it's Representative Boquist's son or Chair Smith has had bad experiences with this. Is just talking to folks is that you see, and I didn't know this, but our office certainly heard from it, is that this really is a statewide issue that calls for some statewide laws, and we hope we found the right tone, and that's what we think we got out of the Senate, is the right tone to bring this bill before you. And so thank you for hearing it. Thank you for your interest in this issue, and be glad to answer any questions.
Well, thank you, Senator Deckert and Susie, for all your hard work on this. This is an important issue, especially right now. We seem to be hearing more and more as we go along, just like you said. And I think everyone has a personal story to relate. Are there any questions of Senator Deckert?
Madam Chair?
Yes. Senator Haas.
We have new amendments to this bill?
I think we do. Patrick?
I was going to ask Senator Deckert if you've seen him and what
have you?
Your take is and where they originated.
It's like everything's amended these days. Patrick, do we have new amendments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did neglect to mention those. I received yesterday after I left, unfortunately, the -A3 amendments, which are included in your packet, I believe they were provided by Senator Decker's office. Maybe Susie would like to talk.
No? Yeah. No?
I think Susie needs to testify here.
I think Susie needs to testify. Could someone explain the -3 amendments?
I was told without, and she really deserves a great deal of credit, that she would prefer to, she is one of those that prefers to be behind the scenes, and I drag her in front of the scenes. The A3 amendments, here's what they do. They, and I'll just kind of summarize. They keep the language on strict liability. They establish a potentially dangerous and dangerous dog classification. All incidences must be unprovoked and off the property of the owner. Has to menace a person, lunging, growling, and talks about killing or injuring a domestic animal. We worked with that same group as the bill traveled over from the Senate to the House. We worked with that same group that we've been working with to further, as you know, perfect the bill. Now, several folks grabbed me on my way in this morning with different, and you may hear different concerns. My request to the committee, and Representative Boquist and I were talking about this yesterday, is when you're working on something, and this group that has been working on it has spent over 30 hours, 40 hours, maybe more, really working on this product. We want to get it to one, as we all mentioned in the hallway outside, as one that everyone nods on, because we really want this to be a consensus and to be the right law. But what I would ask folks who come really late in the process is we do want to move a bill, and this has been up and around for a couple months now. Certainly there was a lot of process and four or five hearings given in the Senate, and so my only request to the committee would be we do want to keep something moving, but we would work with anyone, as indicated yesterday, that would like to perfect the bill or amend, because on this one we're really interested in getting something that really gets at the problem, but also there's something that is consensus, that because everyone that I've talked to has said we see a need here, we want to get the right law out, and
maybe what we need to do is then hear who else is going to testify today, because we have for and against, I'm seeing on that, so maybe that'll give us a better idea. Representative Haas, did that answer your question?
Yes, it did.
Okay. Representative Burley?
Just a quick question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick cursory review of A3, it does appear as though in the A engrossed version, what was under Section 8, the registry of dogs, it appears as though that's dropped out in this A3. Is that correct?
Correct.
So there, in A3, there would be no registry of dogs.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
So there'd be no local registry.
Right.
I think we need to read them, too. Thank you.
But that was one, Madam Chair, Representative Burley, that was one of the requests that was made. That actually, I mean, talking to folks that are in the field, whether it's animal control, vets, and others, it was really good suggestions that were made that here would be a more workable process than having a statewide registry the way that we originally thought would be a good idea. And I thank the folks for working hard to perfect and get some of the language that just it works better not having that statewide registry in there.
Okay.
Thanks.
Representative Boquist?
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Decker, I just want to make sure it's on the record so everybody does know that this bill is the stopgap, for a better word, because city and county ordinances, if they adopted a dog controller, is to preempt this. And so we're not taking away any local control or anything from the cities or the counties, and this is the fail-safe system. Is that not correct, Senator?
No, Madam Chair, I should have pointed that out and maybe led with that. That is a very good point, that this really is your stopgap, and that any city and county ordinances that would supersede that, it's a very good point.
Thank you. And did the other gentleman want to testify? Did you want to testify? Or are you just sitting up here?
Just here to answer questions.
Okay. Any questions? Seeing none. Thank you very much. Lorraine Still. Thank you. Yes, go ahead.
Good morning, Chairman Smith and panel. My name is Lorraine Still, and I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 844. When this bill was first introduced, the Oregon Purebred Dog community opposed this bill. Although we expressed our support for its goals, namely to reduce the number of dangerous dogs and dog-related injuries in Oregon, the amendments that have been made enable us now to give it our support. We originally opposed this legislation because it attempted to solve the problem of dangerous dogs by targeting specific breeds, as the gentleman just before me has stated. Along with Oregon Kennel Clubs, nearly all the respected national animal organizations from the NAIA, a broad-based national coalition of individuals, businesses, and organizations and hobbies that responsibly utilize and enjoy animals, to the American Kennel Club, the American Veterinary Medical Association, the National Animal Control Association, and the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, the American Dog Owners Association also opposed breed-specific legislation. And the reason they do is simple. Breed-specific legislation not only does not work, it actually complicates efforts to solve dangerous dog problems. Breed-specific laws are difficult and expensive to enforce. There is no scientific test that can differentiate dog breeds or mixes, so identification is purely subjective. They do not take into account that the majority of dogs of any breed or mix are not dangerous to the community. They attract criminals to breeds that are portrayed as aggressive regardless of their actual temperament, force pet owners to give up beloved family pets, increase the number of dogs relinquished to shelters, do not address the fundamental problem that the majority of incidents result from violations of other animal control laws, such as dogs running loose or improper control or confinement, or problems arising from failure to properly supervise children and dogs. Give people a false sense of security by categorizing certain dogs as vicious, thereby implying that dogs of other breeds and mixes are not. Are unfair to the thousands of responsible owners of targeted breeds and mixes and to the dogs that are treasured family pets, valued show and performance dogs, working partners in search and rescue, therapy dogs, or participants in other aspects of canine-human interaction. Instead of breed-specific laws, we support laws that hold irresponsible dog owners accountable for the problems their dogs cause. This is true whether the problem is nuisance barking or off-leash menacing. Only laws that draw meaningful distinction between owners who are responsible and owners who are not will lead to improvements we seek. Only an ordinance that penalizes the lawbreakers without assailing dog lovers who responsibly care for their dogs will succeed. Therefore, we are in favor of laws that target high-risk conduct to fight the risk of dangerous dogs in our communities with enforceable penalties. We also strongly support tougher laws and substantial penalties in connection with fighting dogs or using dogs to guard illegal activities. Members of the groups I represent are thankful for the opportunity we were given to work with members of the Oregon Legislature to help draft the bill you now have. It has the potential of becoming one of the most effective dangerous dog laws in the U.S. It not only will reduce the number of truly dangerous dogs in our communities, it will do so without trampling on the rights of responsible dog owners to keep and properly care for the breed of their choice. And again, my name is Lorraine Still. I'm representing NAIA, an active member of the purebred dog community in the Northwest for over 50 years. I helped found the Eugene Kennel Club in 1947, was a charter member of the Walla Walla Kennel Club in 1951, a life member of the Pacific Northwest Shetland Sheepdog Club, charter member of the Emerald Entrail Sheepdog Club, and I've held offices in all of the same. And I've also been actively breeding and exhibiting dogs for well over 50 years.
Thank you very much.
Any questions?
No. Could I ask?
Yes.
What does NAIA stand for?
National Animal Interest Alliance.
Thank you very much. Glenn Stonebrink. And Gordon Folt. Wait. I'm going to call. We're going to have to start moving along here, so.
For the record, Glenn Stonebrink, Oregon Cattlemen's Association. I will be brief, I promise. That only concern, and I did address this concern in the Senate, and I was told by the proponents of the bill it would be taken care of, and perhaps for legislative reasons we could get it cleared up. But in the bill, on page 5, line 30, it describes the dog as a public nuisance, and also and it talks about the statutes on page 1, line 13, OR 609090, and that's part of what I gave to you just now, and I had it folded open to the one area of concern that we have. And that is what will happen to dogs that chase vehicles on premises other than the owner's property. The reason that is a concern to us, those of us that represent rural Oregon, is because, and when I lived on the ranch in Wallowa County for 13 years, we had dogs, and my brother had dogs, and if you drove by our place, you'd be chased by dogs for more than a quarter of a mile. We also had lights that lit up, and I listened to a criminal one time on TV who liked to steal things in farm country, and he said the two things they looked for were lights and dogs. If they were there, they stayed away from those places. In the 13 years we were there, we never lost one thing that I know of. Because if anyone was chasing the place and they saw all those dogs chasing, the dogs never bit anyone. They just love to chase cars. Now, the concern we have is, I believe, and perhaps the proponents of the bill can clarify this, that go back to those days, and my stock dog were chasing someone down the road, it could be arrested, if you will, and it could be neutered under this bill. And stock dogs in a lot of places are worth a lot of money for their breeding capabilities as well as their working capacity. So,
and that's not out of the bill?
That's not out of the bill that I can see. It's okay. Still there. So perhaps some legislative history or clarification for the record would be all we ask. Thank you.
Thank you. Gordon?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Gordon Foltz with the Association of Oregon Counties. Although we had Commissioner Soa involved in the early part, we came in sort of in the middle of this. And I think that the dash, the A3s are at least an attempt to address some of the concerns we had. And primarily, let me express those. While we agree with the intent of creating a dangerous dog law, if you will, and a new crime of possessing a dangerous dog, we are very concerned about the impact on some rural counties of this bill. You're absolutely right. Those counties that have ordinances, and most of the urban counties have ordinances, can basically use their ordinances in lieu of this law. But the other counties would be required to follow the law unless they, too, created an ordinance. And in many of those counties are so small that they don't have animal control. And under this particular legislation, they're going to be required to do a number of things, including a local registry is still potentially, depending upon what version you look at. There's hearing cost involved. There's euthanizing the animals that are involved. And we're trying to find a way, basically, to have the law but not have it negatively impact the small counties. And in that regard, we're asking for a couple more days to work with the sponsor to see if we can't come up with some amendments that address that particular concern. But we think that perhaps procedurally there's a lot in this legislation that's not necessary, but we do believe the Declaration of Dangerous Dog is important. We do understand the intent and would like to concur with that, but try to find a way to minimize the impact that we see on the other counties.
That's my concern, is what we're doing in the rural counties is different than the urban counties. I raised that with Senator Decker, so I'm glad to hear you're working on that issue. If you could have someone with you.
Sorry, I'm Mike Oswald with Multnomah County Animal Services. I was coming up with Gordon. I thought he was going to talk about some other issues, but I think I'm signed up to.
You are signed up, and you're next.
So. Oh, I'm next?
Yeah. I just didn't know who you were.
Apparently clairvoyant, too.
You're very good.
Hi. Mike Oswald, Multnomah County Animal Services. Chair Smith and committee members, thanks for this opportunity. I've had an opportunity to meet with Senator Deckard's staff on this bill on a couple of occasions, along with others, and we're very supportive of the idea of coming up with ways of improving public safety related to animals in the community. And the issues in Oregon, obviously, are there's urban counties and there's rural counties. In Multnomah County, you know, we have a local ordinance that addresses potentially dangerous dogs and has for some 15 years, and have a number of mechanisms and procedures that have proven to be effective in preventing future incidents from happening. But they still happen. But the reason why I'm very involved and supportive of this is that there's really value statewide. Because of not having anything currently on the statutes that address dangerous dogs, those communities across Oregon who do not have local ordinances pertaining to dangerous dogs, people are at risk. Yeah. This is an issue of safety for people. And as you've probably seen some of the studies, that as high as 42% of all of the victims are children. And some of the national studies have shown that we're talking about 300,000, 400,000 children that are injured and actually go into emergency rooms every year and across the country from serious dog attacks. And I think that the strength of this particular proposal that Senator Deckard has come up with is really drawing attention to the very, fortunately, very small percentage of very serious incidents that go on in the community, and that there needs to be something statewide that addresses that. And there's, because without that, what we have are people in those communities that essentially are unprotected. And another issue why I believe it's important to have something statewide is you can have cities and counties in the state currently can have ordinances that address this, and there are many counties and cities that do, but the majority don't. And what happens is that people with their animals move out of jurisdictions with those animals. And we experience it. We've got documented cases, and so do other counties. They're moving from one county to another county. And if it goes from a county, say, that has regulations and conditions about continued ownership, and it goes to a county that has no conditions or restrictions, unfortunately, that community waits until another incident occurs. Having this statewide, at a minimum, talking about at least like Gordon was mentioning, dangerous dogs and potentially dangerous dogs, then counties maintaining some record and registry of that within those counties, and they can share that information. But it's a way of trying to ensure that we can interrupt this whole issue of continued potentially dangerous behavior going on with dogs, and so we're very supportive, and I believe the bill is really very close to being reached a consensus on this, and I can answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Foltz or Mr. Oswald? Representative Berquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, the county has raised the issue of you know, is there a county exemption? And I believe in the amendment there is a county exemption. And, of course, was this issue raised over on the Senate side, too?
I think it must have been, because it was in the original bill, in the engrossed version of it. It outlines it 609015, that is the exemption for those counties that have an ordinance. And in the A engrossed bill, it talks about the counties can exempt all but about three or four pieces of the new legislation, but everything else is exempted. Under the new bill, proposed amendments, the dash threes, although that exemption isn't mentioned, I think it's intended that if it isn't specifically mentioned, that the county can, a county can exempt all provisions in the dash threes if through their ordinance. In other words, they can do something by ordinance. But what I was trying to say earlier is that not every county has an ordinance, and therefore you would require those counties that didn't want to go through a voluminous number of provisions here and requirements that would add cost would have to adopt an ordinance in order to be able to exclude the bill from applying to them. But it does exclude those that already have it now. So we were trying to find a simplified way to make the declaration of dangerous dog, but not have the imposed cost on the small counties. And that's what we're still trying to examine if we have a couple more days to work on this legislation.
Great. Any follow-up?
Yeah, Madam Chair, just more of a statement. I mean, I have a problem with a couple of days as part of that based on, you know, what the committee chair does. But, I mean, a simple ordinance is a simple answer. And most rural counties are pretty simple, because I have ranches in rural counties. So I just think we have a bill that needs addressed, and time is running short. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Pass.
Thank you. I, as a former journalist, I covered a fatal pit bull attack on a young girl. And it wasn't in Portland. It was in Malala, in rural Oregon. And I think this is a public safety issue. And because small counties don't have the wherewithal or don't want to or are bothered by doing this, I just don't think that's a reasonable way to address this. It's a public safety issue. We're passing lots of laws dealing with methamphetamines, and if one of the counties said, no, we don't want to do that, that would be unacceptable. And I don't think this is that different. This is public safety. I know from the news business that while these attacks may be rare, they're not that rare. It seems like they pop up in the news once or twice a year in Oregon. And Multnomah County is right. They're often very serious, sometimes even fatal. And I think it's just a little unreasonable for counties to say, we don't want to do this.
Madam Chair, Representative House, may I explain, may respond to that? We're not trying to suggest that you don't pass a law that says it's a dangerous dog that somebody's going to enforce. There's one thing to declare that dangerous dog is illegal to possess wherever they may be, whether it be the sheriff enforcing that, whether it be an animal control office. The way this legislation is designed, it says you will have an animal control office and you go through a number of hurdles. We're suggesting at least one option that we're considered out in the hall was that you make the dangerous dog declaration so that whoever's enforcing it has to at least pick up and address the issue that you're talking about, the public safety issue. How that's processed, whether you be prescriptive here or whether you allow some local flexibility, maybe it even be a court, is the other question. And that's what we're trying to avoid, the extra cost and the prescriptiveness of the legislation that's proposed here. But I understand your point.
Representative Burley.
Thank you. I read the 844A quite thoroughly, and I see that a couple of my questions are still in the A3. And what Mr. Stonebrink commented on, I was kind of thinking along the same lines. I mean, I'm thinking about my Lhasa Apso that when she's soaking wet, maybe weighs 3 pounds, and she runs off the property barking at somebody. Is that menacing? You know, is she going to be declared a potentially dangerous dog? And if so, under Section 4, which is page 3, line 19 specifically, if that's the case, then just simply maintaining a potentially dangerous dog is now a punishment, is punishable. And I don't quite understand what that means. I mean, if you have a potentially dangerous dog that for whatever reason is declared such, if I'm reading that correctly, the simple fact that I'm maintaining that dog is now punishable. That's now a crime, an offense. Am I reading that correctly or not?
I'm sure. I'm not sure. I'll let the dog control officer.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, there in the drafts of this bill as it's been moving along and developing, there's two concepts. One is a dangerous dog, and one is a potentially dangerous dog. And the dangerous dog are those serious incidents that Representative Hass was mentioning. The potentially dangerous dog concept is one of identifying by very specific behavior that anybody could observe, a dog off their property chasing, menacing someone. A potentially dangerous dog is to, it's a, like putting people on notice that there's been an incident that's occurred, and there may be some restrictions placed on continued ownership, but the owner can continue to have the dog. For example, it depends upon the details within the bill, and I think that's what Mr. Fultz was talking about, is if there is an opportunity to work through some of the fine details on this, it depends on whether or not it's a focus on dangerous dogs exclusively or the whole issue of potentially dangerous dogs. That's really in the details there, but the experience that we've had in Multnomah County has been where there is a potentially dangerous dog ordinance. It imposes restrictions like the dog has to be kept on the owner's property or on a leash, which is in compliance with the law, and if any further incidents occur, then further sanctions could be imposed, but it's normally not in the same response as to a very dangerous dog situation where the restrictions are much higher or you can't even have a dog of that particular nature.
Well, there's no question, and I agree with Representative Hass and everybody else. I mean, when you've got a dangerous dog, there's no question in my mind. I appreciate the comments earlier about trying to avoid species-specific because, you know, not all pit bulls are dangerous dogs necessarily. But it's this potentially dangerous, and that's where it's such a gray area to me, and I, you know, when I see something like what it says on line 19, page 3 of the Dash A3 amendments, simply maintaining a potentially dangerous dog is punishable. So I got to get rid of the dog? I mean, you know, yeah, fine me because my dog ran off the property, but I don't think a loss of ops is going to hurt anybody. Maybe bark him to death, but, you know, I mean, it's an extreme example, but I think it just kind of points out some of the issues that I think would have to be worked through this thing.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, that's exactly, I think, where we're at right now is working through those details and making sure that there is consensus on what is potentially dangerous, how that relates to dangerousness, and what are the restrictions or conditions on ownership in the community. And for, again, in many of these programs, potentially dangerous dog, people can continue to own their dogs, and the requirements and conditions are that they continue to comply with the leash law responsibilities, if that's the case, and that they're subject to fines. So it's a commensurate response to the level of what kind of issue is manifested. So I think that's really the key to this, is understanding what's occurred, what's the commensurate kind of conditions or restrictions for continued ownership in the community, and at some level where it's very serious, then if the bill would say that you cannot own a dangerous dog, then you couldn't own them. But up until that point, it could follow many different directions. So that's the detail of the bill.
Thank you. And I just want to reiterate, Representative Burley, that Senator Deckard has offered to work on any of these issues that we bring forward. So I think that's one of the things that's certainly worthy of bringing our attention to. Thank you very much. John Powell? Is Mary Botkin still here? She's next. She might be. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Powell. Before you, representing State Farm Insurance Companies and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Madam Chair, members, first let me begin by apologizing to Senator Deckard because this is the first time I've entered this fray, and I'm not here to kill the bill by any means and plan on working with the work group, but we are late entries to this issue for a whole host of reasons. Probably this is one of the lower priority issues both for sheriffs and for insurance companies. However, it is important at how the bill ends up in its final form. For sheriffs and rural counties, their role in this will be important, and I'll try to drag one in to take part in the discussions. From the insurance standpoint, the concept of strict liability, which is applied in the bill, causes this concern. If indeed strict liability is adopted, most, if not all, insurance companies may well begin underwriting by breed of dog. Currently, many insurance companies do underwrite. They will not insure, sell you a homeowner's policy if you have a pit bull, for example, or a Rottweiler, or a breed like that. We get letters from you folks every year. Two or three legislators will send me a letter from a constituent who's angry about that. It's everybody else's pit bull, not mine. My pit bull has never growled and shown its teeth and would never bite anybody. And they're angry because an insurance company is underwriting on that basis. Currently, there's a market that they can go and get homeowners insurance. Our fear is that we'll be placed in the situation as they were in the state of Washington this last session, with legislation saying you cannot underwrite by breed. And so that's kind of the conundrum we find ourselves in with the concept of strict liability. We do agree that dogs present a problem and a growing problem. I'm amazed at the number of people who have dogs. I'm amazed at the number where people take dogs. I'm just doggone amazed. We do know it's problematic, and we'll try to play a constructive role in the process as it proceeds.
Thank you. Quick question. What did they do in the state of Washington for underwriting?
Madam Chair, the bill did not pass.
Okay.
But I think you could tell in the tenor of an earlier witness that that becomes an issue.
Yeah. Any questions for John? Mm. Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you
very much. Did you find Mary Botkin? Marcia? Okay. And she's the last one. Unless Mary comes in.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Marcia Keith. I'm here today representing the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association and also here to support Senate Bill 844 and the A3 amendments. Like an earlier witness, we had concerns with the original bill relative to the breed-specific language, and we would continue to have those concerns should the situation that John Powell described materialize as a result of passing the A3 amendments. We, however, strongly support the rest of the provisions in Senate Bill 844. We truly believe that the situation involving vicious dogs and violent attacks on other animals and human beings needs to be addressed in no uncertain terms by the state of Oregon, and really have no problem with the notion we had no problem with the notion of strict liability. If it means that it gets translated into breed specific, we would have some concerns. We also had no problem with the potential of a statewide registry, but we're also sensitive to the predicament that raises for rural counties. So what I'm here to say, I guess, is what we have always from the beginning strongly supported the concept of the bill with the breed-specific language out of it, and we would continue to be supportive of the bill and hope that some version of a bill that addresses this issue can emerge from this legislature, and we would be very happy to work on that outcome.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you. Becky Maddox, did you want to testify? She came from Union County, I guess, and hadn't signed up for it. I got a note, so welcome.
Thank you very much. Sorry to be late,
but okay.
I didn't know you had to sign up.
So. Oh, that's okay.
I'm one of those country cousins. As you said, I'm from Union County. I've been doing animal control up there for about 16 years. And several years ago, we did indeed discover we needed an aggressive and dangerous amendment in our ordinance. So we put that in, and it's worked quite well. I see a need for a statewide bill or a statewide law, because there are too many counties in eastern and central Oregon that have no county animal control, no city animal control. They're strictly state law governed. For instance, I'm the only full-time person in about seven counties. There's a couple of part-time, one's being laid off at the end of this year. Our animal shelter is the only one between Ontario and Hood River, the Dalles. So we get a lot of business, and we don't have a whole lot of money to do it with. So those provisions are of concern, both to me and my sheriff, and to everyone else in our region, that we not be bound into something that's going to cost us money. And if we have our own ordinance that is working well, we'd like to continue to use it. Any questions?
Any questions for Ms. Maddox? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you
for coming. Senator Decker, do you want to add anything after you heard the testimony?
Sure, of course.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ryan Decker, I know you need to get to the floor. Just two quick points. One is on Mr. Foltz's issues. We want to, whatever form that takes, but we want to ensure that Representative Boquist's point is taken into account, that proper exemption is in place. We think it's in there, the exemption for counties, to ensure that they have the freedom and flexibility they need, but would be happy to wordsmith that in any fashion that y'all choose. The second on, well, the two other things I'd mention, on Mr. Stonebrink's point, that's actually existing law. And so from what Mr. Taylor tells me, that is actually current law. Well, we could delete the current law, but it's nothing that is in this that affects that scenario that he spoke to, and would be willing to revisit that if we want to change current law. And then the third point on the menacing part, we tried to get at it, and maybe it wasn't perfected, but we used the reasonable person standard so that that you really, on the lapso opso or any scenario like that, hopefully it would be good, prudent judgment would be exercised, that they were actually lunging, growling, snarling, or putting the person in, a reasonable person, in fear of their own safety. But if we needed to toughen that up a little, certainly would be willing to do it to ensure that...
We've got to see her snarl.
But I would hate to be responsible for Representative Burley's lopsu-lopsu having an animal control person around it. So with that said, however you want to proceed, just mindful of the clock, and yeah, be happy if we want to do it in a conference committee where both sides kind of retain their ability to further amend the bill, that would be wonderful, but however you decide to proceed.
Okay. I think at this point we'll kind of reconsider what we're doing, and you're willing to work on the issue, so if we need to put a group together, we can do that, and I'm sure we can find a way to get this done. Thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing at about 8:44. I know we've changed the date of the committee, saved the date, so I hope everybody put in their date that they want. And I think we'll just, I don't know if we're having a meeting Friday or not. We're on 24-hour notice, so.
This is one thing that we need to get through. Think this is a
Yeah. No, I think that's why I would like to know on both the Wolf bill and this bill. We're the committee. For that, we're adjourned.